This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 19th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 282. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And a double feature on the big deal feature as Justin Trudeau's China crisis continues. Trudeau appointed his special rapporteur, longtime Trudeau family friend and former Governor General David Johnston. And did China help make Ken Sim the mayor of Vancouver? I talked to former Mayor Kennedy Stewart and Brad West, the mayor of Port Coquitlam, who sounded the alarm about China's interference when other politicians were too scared to say a word. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Kennedy Stewart was the 40th mayor of Vancouver. He served from 2018 to 2022. In 2018, Stewart narrowly defeated Ken Sim, but in 2022, Sim won by a 36,000-vote landslide. Did Sim and his ABC Vancouver party benefit from help from the Chinese government? On March 16th, Ken Sim had this to say.
If there is proof of this, I'd be as mad as hell as everyone else. But right now, there are a bunch of insinuations, and it's actually quite hurtful.
In May of last year, Kennedy Stewart was visited by agents from the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. They warned him that the Chinese government and its proxy groups were planning to interfere in the civic election to help candidates favorable to China.
You had a meeting with officials from CSIS in May of last year, several months before election day in October. Set the scene for me. Walk me back to what happened that day.
You know, every morning I have a briefing with my staff, and one day, you know, as we were going through my schedule, they said, oh, CSIS has requested a meeting with you. And I thought, CSIS, that's weird. Anyway, I took the meeting, and so we scheduled it, and then it was quite a long meeting. It was about, I don't know, 2 hours long. The two CSIS staff came to brief me. I actually asked to see their badges, and they showed me their badges to show that say they were CSIS, and they said they had to brush them off because they never did this. they don't typically brief people. And you know, and that was part of the conversation as well, like, why are you briefing? Why do you think this is important? And so what they started with was some going through some pretty standard literature about what foreign interference looks like different ways that foreign governments can interfere with your local politics, your local elections, and then started really just asking questions about my chief of staff, Neil Monckton, was with me, just about, you know, our experiences. Have we noticed particular things? And, you know, it kind of went, I wasn't that helpful to them, I must say. I didn't really have a lot of information to pass along. It was, you know, the election year, and I was just, as usual, up to my eyeballs in work. So anyway, I found it more of an informational session, but I told them, like, hey guys, this is going to show up in my public calendar. So I'll have to say something to media, which I did. And I said, so what do I tell people, you know? And they just said, tell them that you met with us about foreign interference. And then I asked them, well, why are you briefing me? And they said, well, we've got this information. We've been, there was a senior official there, but there was also an expert from the China desk. That's who did the majority of the briefing and questioning. They said they had information, and it was basically being ignored. And so this was an opportunity to make the public aware. So in fact, they were happy that this would come out in my public calendar, so it would get some attention. And then we left it at that. There are some follow-up meetings as scheduled, not with me, but with other folks. And I believe they told me they were briefing other people. Like, for example, I think Elections BC had been briefed. I think that our chief electoral officer at the city, who is the clerk, was briefed. And that was that.
The CSIS leaks reported in the Global Mail focus on the role of Vancouver Consul General Tong Chao-Ling in both the 2021 federal election and the 2022 Vancouver civic election. Tong raised eyebrows for publicly criticizing Kennedy Stewart on more than one occasion.
Well, just walk me through that up and down relationship.
Sure. I mean, lots of folks don't know that, especially out here on the West Coast, where there's, you know, limited access to Ottawa, and in Vancouver, you don't, you know, the head of government's in Victoria here provincially. So actually, you get quite a lot of consular activity as mayor, and I think past mayors will tell you this. Consul generals are out here that are always looking to meet with the mayor. So for example, the consul general from Turkey contacted me once and said, "I'm trying to get a direct flight between Turkey and Vancouver. You know, can you help us?" And I did, and we had to get that established. And so that's the kind of work you can do. And so you do have relationships with, in fact, they could take all day, every day. There's so many requests for meetings that you can't do them all. I treated everybody the same at the beginning of my term. When COVID hit, the consul general was very helpful, of China, was very helpful getting PPE to frontline responders. We had a huge shortage of PPE, and, you know, they showed up with boxes of the stuff and took it down to St. Paul's Hospital, which I was, you know, grateful for. And that was, I mean, that was a really terrible time for everybody. So any help was very appreciated. But as you mentioned, when the Meng Wanzhou and the two Michaels stuff started to heat up, you know, I think we all looked at that when, you know, our citizens are being kidnapped and held as hostage in a political debate that everybody thought, well, that's not a great thing. But then when the threat specifically came against Michael Chong and previously to Jenny Kwan, then I said, I really don't want to talk to the Chinese consul general anymore. This isn't really a core part of my work. So that's it. I just said, I'm not doing this. And actually got very little media attention. People were I just kind of put out a statement saying, I'm not meeting anymore. This is, you're threatening our democracy. So I'm out. Really concerned about Taiwan and trying to strengthen relations there. A great Taiwanese community here in Vancouver. My niece is Taiwanese. And so I was approached to start this Friendship City program, which I thought would be a great one. And then things really started going sideways with the consul general, who would, you know, had publicly basically denounced me, which is way out of line for somebody who's a diplomat, right? I mean, I would be at a couple of functions where the room would be full, it'd be either the Pink Pearl or the Floater restaurant. The room would be full of MLAs and maybe MPs, and the consul general and police were there. She stood up essentially and denounced the prime minister, denounced Canada, said that China was being angered, you know, something to that effect. And I thought, holy cow, this is way out of line. And this person should have been expelled a long time ago, but there was really no action taken. So our relationship really deteriorated. I think Jenny Kwan will also tell you this, our invitations to various events dried up. If the consul general was there, at least I was not welcome to be there. Essentially, these are locally hosted events. And, that's kind of how that all played out. There was initial concern, and then it turned into open hostility with the consul general. And again, I had the 99% of my job had nothing to do with that, so I just kept doing my job.
Did your campaign notice anything that was developing that was affecting your campaign, as well as anything that other campaigns were doing that was confirming the suspicion that you were given from CSIS?
I can't say I like. When you're a mayor in a campaign leading a team of candidates, which I did, you're kind of the hood ornament on the car, right? So you're up every morning, you're out either, you know, door knocking or greeting people on the street or doing debates or prepping for debates or doing media. Like, so you don't really have your hands on the day-to-day you know, you don't know what the door knockers are hearing. You don't really know, because that's not really your job. So I can't say that I personally noticed anything through the campaign. The one thing I do know is that, you know, at one point our fundraising dried up maybe 3 weeks out from the election. And that was, you know, there was, that was strange, but I can't really, it's hard to know why that happened. You know, I gotta say, like, ABC ran a very well financed, you know, they pretty well put $2 million on the books into a smear campaign against me for a good year, and that was really effective. You know, they lied and said I was going to bring in a mobility pricing, which I couldn't do and wasn't going to do. But when you run wall to wall TV and radio ads saying this, it's hard to fight back. So, I mean, they ran an effective, I would say, you know, duplicitous campaign, but that's politics. I accept that. Congratulated Ken Sim and his team on election night, and then got on with my life. So I wouldn't know. I mean, you always hear things, but you can't confirm them. So it's not a, you know, I don't really feel that comfortable talking about gossip. I think, you know, I think I'll leave it at that. But, you know, others can probably tell more the stories better than I can.
Do you think that David Johnston's appointment is the right appointment? And do you think that this is the right strategy? Or should he just pull off the Band-Aid and throw caution to the wind and get a public inquiry happening as soon as possible?
I actually think it was the right move, and I've said this. I think, like, maybe a public inquiry is the best thing to do, but maybe there's something more powerful that needs to happen, you know, something that you would be, for example, able to subpoena people. So I think having a special rapporteur was a good choice at the beginning. I do think that because all the David Johnston's going to be doing is having a recommendation to the Prime Minister cabinet as to what path they should take and what the scope. Today, he announced that he's able to set his own mandate. So I do think that was the right thing to do, because it's pretty quick. And then and it gives everybody a time to think about something, because an inquiry can take an awfully long time. And so you want to make sure that you get the parameters right. So I think that was the right move. I also think the appointment was a good one. It would be hard to find, you know, the shortlist is pretty short on who you would get. So I do agree with it, but it will be up to, you know, we'll see what they all come up with. But I do think they should be including not just elections, but nominations. I mean, I've been through three of those, and those are very underregulated. You know, the parties essentially look after those at the federal and provincial levels, and all kinds of shenanigans happen through those processes. I mean, in the U.S., they have primaries that are overseen by the states, which are way cleaner. So that, you know, that should be something to look at, but also municipal elections, especially in big cities. You know, you say my campaign, you know, didn't raise as much money, and you're right. I only spent $1 million. Mm-hmm. You know, and my opponent spent $2 million at least. That is during the election period. He says he's been campaigning for 4 years, so he's probably spent many millions of dollars. And in previous elections, as you know, expenditures could be, you know, $5-7 million. So these are big campaigns, and then when you win. You're in control of massive assets, and you have access to all kinds of confidential information. So I know we tend to downplay the importance of municipalities as being kind of the kid brother of the other senior levels of government, but municipalities are so integral to the operations of any country. We've got to take their elections seriously, and we really haven't in the history of Canada. We kind of, the provinces find them a big inconvenience. And it's only recently that Elections BC has even started just compiling information about local elections. Like, they don't, when we submit our finances at the federal level, when you run an election, you have to have a certified auditor go through all your books, and you have to turn your bank records and access to bank accounts over to the auditor. Then all that information is shipped to Elections Canada, who has all their own auditors go through all the same thing, and they trace it right down to the penny. They trace whether people actually live at the addresses that are listed on their tax receipts. We don't do anything like that in the city of Vancouver, like, or in BC for municipal elections. We just send in sheets of people we say donated to us. They're never checked. They're not verified. And then there's no access to bank accounts. So like this is wide open. It could easily be abused. And provincial governments have known this forever, and they really haven't done much to fix it. It's not Elections BC's fault. They follow the legislation that they're given to oversee. And they also do it with the resources that they have. And they are very under-resourced to do this kind of work. Like, municipal elections are a tag on to their real job, which is provincial elections. And they neither have the capacity or really the mandate to do the kind of investigations that you're suggesting should occur. I would suggest they should occur as well. But then folks who want to flout the law or want to influence in ways that are not on the books, they know these laws too, right? And so, it's more than a loophole. It's like a giant hole in the fence that folks can enter if they want to. And it really, what's really bad is it really, disempowers the local electorate if the playing field isn't even, and especially if it's foreign interference.
Kennedy Stewart, who was 40th mayor of the city of Vancouver from 2018 to 2022, now director of the Center for Public Policy Research at Simon Fraser University. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Bob.
Also on March 17th, Premier David Eby had this to say.
Yeah, I've been following the reporting on this, and obviously I am very troubled by the allegations related to British Columbia generally, and Canadians deserve a thorough and independent investigation that provides us with information about what's going on. I have reached out through my staff to the federal government to ask for a full briefing on this. I've not received that yet, but I look forward to it. And at this point, I don't feel that I'm in a position to comment on the credibility of the documents other than to say they're very troubling and that British Columbians and Canadians deserve a full accounting.
What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Brad West is the mayor of Port Coquitlam and the chair of the TransLink Mayor's Council, first elected in 2018 and re-elected by acclamation in 2022. Brad West has been outspoken on China's human rights record and China's foreign interference in Canada for years. In 2019, he successfully convinced the Union of BC Municipalities to stop the Chinese government from sponsoring the convention. First, I wanted to know his reaction to the biggest scandal of 2023 involving communist China's meddling in Canadian elections.
Does any of this surprise you in any way? I mean, you've been watching it for a while, but do these revelations by CSIS, carried by the Globe and Mail, surprise you in any way?
No, they don't surprise me. It's confirmation of, again, I think what we've known for quite some time, which is the government of China is engaged in a very well-coordinated, a very methodical, a planned campaign to expand their influence in Canada. And that involves building relationships with elected officials at every level. It involves financial support of people who they believe are supportive of their agenda. It involves what I describe as sort of this web of influence that they're trying to create that crosses many of our institutions. It includes political parties. It includes universities and the academic world. It includes media, and particularly prevalent as well in the corporate sector. They almost have these, I guess you could describe them as astroturf groups, this overlapping network of ex-politicians, ex-bureaucrats, government relations agencies, the China-Canada Business Council. They have a whole host of voices in this country that are singing off of their song sheet. Those people are pretty quiet these days. I suspect many of them are running for cover. But I think all of this needs the disinfecting power of sunshine. We need to bring all of this to light because I think it goes quite deep. And I think in many respects, they have been successful over not years, but decades in creating a dynamic where Canadian decision makers are very reluctant to do anything that would be contrary to their wishes. And so what we are getting now, I think, is more real life examples of that. We're getting examples of the form that it has taken, including supporting candidates for office in their political party's nomination process, in terms of funneling of money to political candidates during the election, in terms of trying to use their influence amongst a certain segment of the population to support political candidates. These revelations are showing us the how, but I think we've known for quite some time that this is what they're doing. In fact, if you pay any attention to the speeches of Chinese officials in China, they're very open about this as well. I mean, they talk about it. I mean, whether it's the Belt and Road Initiative or other things, the work of the United Front, it's not exactly sort of secret society stuff. They're pretty open about this is the type of things that they're doing. And if you've done any reading, about their efforts in Australia, you'll know that this is the exact same playbook that they're using in our country.
I asked Mayor Brad West about his protest and boycott of the Chinese government's cocktail party and sponsorship of the Union of BC Municipalities Convention in 2019.
I knew that this had been a longstanding practice, but I naively thought that in the context of two of our fellow Canadians being held hostage, they would see that it wouldn't look good. And if anything, it was not the right time to be having that continue. And so I began a process of engaging with them, wrote them a letter, spoke to Arjun Singh, who was the president of the UBCM at the time, and really felt like basically they were jerking me around. I got a lot of non-answers or, oh yeah, we're looking at it and, we'll consider your input. But in the final conversation I had, they said, oh no, we're going to proceed. And I was very upfront with them at that point that I would be public about my opposition. And that kind of set off that course of events that led to the boycott of the conference, of the reception, me encouraging other mayors and city councilors to join me. Very few did. I'm sad to say. There was a handful of city councilors, no other mayors, but a handful of city councilors who joined me in the protest outside of the reception. Most of the city councilors were from my own city, and kudos to them standing with me during that time. But who did stand with us out there were members of the Chinese Canadian community, the Taiwanese community, the Hong Kong community, the Uyghur community, people who know firsthand the government of China's insidious agenda. And, you know, I am pleased that we eventually shamed members of the UBCM into putting an end to that practice. But, you know, to me, it was pretty clear what this was all about. And it's laughable, the excuses that people came up with at that time. But it was always clear to me. The government of China wasn't doing all of this out of the goodness of their heart. They have an agenda. And this was one of the ways that they were able to pursue their agenda, which is to gain greater influence and grow their soft power within Canadian governance and decision making. And CSIS and others have been identifying this and warning about this for years now, decades. And it's been well covered as well by members of the media, by folks like yourself, Bob. So there is part of me watching all of this unfold now that has to laugh a little bit that people are, you know, kind of expressing this this shock. I guess it's like that scene in Casablanca, but I'm shocked about the gambling in the casino. This has been in front of our noses for quite some time.
The other news that happened before the latest CSIS leaks that were revealed was that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has appointed former Governor General David Johnston as the special rapporteur to oversee a probe of the foreign interference allegations. Opposition parties have wanted a public inquiry. They want this to go one step further to essentially a logical conclusion. What do you think of that appointment, and what do you think about the Prime Minister's strategy?
I think it's a delay tactic. I think it's done in the hopes that some bigger story will come along and Canadians will turn their attention elsewhere and people will forget about all of this, because right now there's a lot of public attention on it. I think that's the political strategy that's being employed with this appointment. Because on the merits, I can't see why you would have this interim step. You know, you sort of, well, here's this special rapporteur, which, by the way, no one ever heard of that phrase until they've just invented it now. No regular person anyways. So special rapporteur, whatever that is, to see whether maybe we need a public inquiry. Delay tactic. If this doesn't call for a public inquiry, what does? I mean, what more do you need to hear or confirm to make a determination as a prime minister that a full independent public inquiry is required to go from the top to the bottom of our institutions and ensure that they are free from foreign influence? And that the interests that are being served by our institutions are the interests of Canadian citizens. I mean, to me, it seems very simple and very straightforward. And so I believe it's the delay tactic. And then you layer on the fact that it appears to be the case that the special rapporteur is fairly well connected to the prime minister. And you would think, again, from his perspective, knowing that there's a lot of eyeballs on this, you would want to have, just a complete unimpeachable process here that people can have confidence in. So I don't think that this is the right approach. I don't think it serves Canadians' interests. And certainly, you know, for what it's worth, which is probably not much, but I've added my voice saying early on that this is absolutely cries out for a full public inquiry.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. Mayor of Port Coquitlam, Brad West, talking about the foreign interference by China in Canadian elections and the need to get to the bottom of it.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Disney changes Taiwanese character to Chinese in American-born Chinese. Fans of the best-selling 2006 Jean Luen Wan book recently discovered that the Disney Plus TV adaptation of the series changed the origin of Wai Chen from Taiwanese to Chinese. On March 15th, a screenshot of the synopsis of episode 1 on IMDb was shared on Reddit. The IMDb description states that Jin is assigned a new student shadow from China named Wai Chen Sun. Based on the IMDb page for the show, the actor who plays Wai Chen, Jim Liu, is actually from Taiwan. He is a former Taekwondo champion from Taipei who turned to acting at age 17. In Kyoto news, Japan to crack down on crime rings that recruit via social media. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida called for stronger measures against online posts seeking people for yami baito, literally meaning dark part-time jobs, while stressing the need to conduct cyber patrols to eradicate recruiting for criminal activities. He also directed focus be put on ensuring the protection of personal information, such as customer data, to prevent scammers from using it in their schemes. In Hong Kong Free Press, China's top office overseeing Hong Kong and Macau to report directly to Communist Party central leadership. According to a proposal from Beijing, the Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office, led by Xia Baolong, will be restructured and will function as a working body of the Communist Party of China's Central Committee. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland Trailblazers unveil new mascot, a hipster beanie-wearing Bigfoot named Douglas Fur. That's F-U-R. Douglas Fur, who stands about 7 feet tall, wears a red and black plaid vest and a red beanie featuring a Blazers pinwheel logo. The team commissioned a life-sized wooden carving of him, which will be permanently displayed in Kid City on the 300 level at the Moda Center, and the new mascot will be featured on limited edition Nike Biketown bikes around Portland. The Blazers are hoping the mascot becomes an instant hit and a fabric of the franchise moving forward. In King 5, Seattle, celebrating the years-long partnership between Seattle and Galway, Ireland on St. Patrick's Day. Seattle and Galway formalized a sister city partnership in 1986. One of the most visible symbols of the relationship sits in prominent locations in each city. In 1993, the city of Galway unveiled a monument celebrating its sister city that contains a bronze marker that features the geophysical data of Seattle and points directly to the Emerald City more than 4,000 miles away. In the year 2000, the city of Seattle unveiled its own waterfront marker that sits across from Pier 66. There is a description of the sister city program in two languages, and the stone points directly at Galway through the center of the earth. In the Times Colonist, $1 billion rail and barge network proposed for Island would help ease congestion at Vancouver. Under Island Rail Corp's ambitious proposal, it would offer local, national, and international rail freight service and serve local passengers and tourists up and down Vancouver Island. Cargo would come into Port Alberni and be loaded onto rail cars. From there, the freight would be carried by rail to Nanaimo, where 50 cars, with two stacked containers each, could go straight onto a barge to the mainland. From the start, the company wants to see corridor land ceded back to First Nations. Land was expropriated from First Nations in the early 1900s to develop the now shuttered ENN rail line. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to social workers across British Columbia, the people who help vulnerable children, youth, and adults. It's Social Work Week in BC from March 19th to March 25th.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 19th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 19th of March in 1958, 24 people died in the Monarch Underwear Company fire in New York City? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.